that I'll reconvene the hearing. Mr. Wells.
Morning.
Please just simply ahead for some questions, please.
Sure.
So you provided the amendments to Bob's code, and I was interested, just how did the provisions wind up, I think if they're in the operative plan,
yeah.
How did they get in there in the first place?
My understanding is that they were the result of a consent order on with respect to the current plan, and there was an appeal, I can't give you absolute certainty if it was involved, but I believe that there was one participant in some of the detail that was resolved here was the late Councillor Lawrence, who had a particular interest in the nature conservation values, etc. And they were very detailed sort of outcomes handed through to give confidence to everybody as to the outcome, and hence why this is in that detail, I think.
But it was a plan change sought by the Bob Cove in the first place. Is that how it went through?
I believe it was a submission made to the previous district plan review, review process.
Right. Okay. So, I'm trying to work out then what's changed since then that would lead to a need to amend the rules?
Primarily, just obviously the experience of having implemented the rules and the opportunity to review the effectiveness and efficiency of the rules. Mm-hmm. And I think, as I mentioned, there's no great dispute over the vision as well as by those objective policies and rules. There's just an argument I make that there's an opportunity to be more efficient around the and briefer around some of those rules to just reduce some of the compliance issues. Otherwise, nothing major has changed.
In terms of the amendments you've made, you know, if you've got 22.3 there, on that objective 22.2.6, you've got that as deleted, and then, it seems to me that it leaves hanging the policy under. If you take that objective out, then the policy below it doesn't actually have an objective that it relates to?
Yes, I should point out, I didn't want to make the page look too busy, but that would naturally be moved to sit under the objective that sits below it. It talks about the Bob's Cove Rural Residential Zone generally.
In terms of the new policy over the page, so it's over the page on my 110, 111112, the planting that has occurred prior to the related building occurring within 50 metres, so just when I read that I couldn't work out whether there's supposed to be planting within 50 metres of Glenorchy Road, or is it when there's a building that's within 50 metres of Glenorchy Road, then the planting's required?
yes, I think I alerted some ambiguity around some of the stuff in the existing rules. And before I answer your question more precisely, I was trying to just reflect the principle of some very detailed rules that felt more like conditions to me. Put it back up into a policy level, and the intention was in relation to any planting within 50 metres of Queensland Glenorchy Road, which was being put in place for mitigation purposes, I would accept and welcome any improvement to the reviewed any along those lines.
Okay. My only concern was just in regard to, because there was quite a bit regarding setbacks and things like that that was being removed, just whether the still the same intent could be followed on just through the policy, but we'll probably look at that more in more detail in deliberations on it. So,
sure. Yeah. If I could make one last comment in respect to that. The example you used of the setback is one rule which I do believe needs to be fundamentally thought about in a convention, that you've got flexibility in terms of the density rules, so it does provide for an average of 4,000 square metre lot sizes, so you're getting smaller lot sizes, you have a higher standard internal setback rule. And what has actually happened is that the applications that have been applied for have constantly sought to breach that internal setback rule because they've created smaller lots. It strikes me as an unnecessary rule. And if there's one thing I can provide you, you may feel this is unnecessary, but I did print off some copies of an existing subdivision layout that's been approved that may just help your deliberations.
Yep, well, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Thanks.
All right, having some further. Thank you.
That, I should just clarify, only shows the part of the Glenorchy-owned land south of the Glenorchy Queenstown Road. The area to the north is a more historic subdivision that's been replaced on the. So that was the second subdivision that was completely developed. So it's not showing the entire area. As it should have provided you the picture on the rules of the site, but you would be able to find that through the requirements of the council plans, or I could provide that if you needed it.
Just one. It looks like in relation to Is this rural lifestyle zone?
Rural residential.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Thank you.
Okay. The only question I have, Mr. Bowles, is if we were to conclude that there was some justification in your changes that you proposed, and we would recommend that to the council, what evidence would we be relying on to do that?
Well, I suppose I take the point that I've provided you a bunch of recommendations, and I've spoken quite generally to the main comments as to sort of the efficiency and what have you.
And they make notes of those comments.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, does that constitute the entire evidence that we should rely on?
It does. I would hope that I'm not arguing these are really significant changes. And I would hope that the level of sort of commentary and evidence that I've given you would be sufficient for you to conclude that they can be appropriate.
Lunch break.
Thank you, Commissioners, for starting with two quick comments. Firstly, slightly unrelated, I was interested on the memorandum that the Council requested from Ms. Barn about preservation and protection. And I would analyse it differently and if you were interested in that at all, at the end of this hearing, if you wanted to have the benefit of that, then you have to just read that time in your hands.
Would be happy to have an alternative opinion. We need anything like that, we need by 2 p.m. tomorrow at the latest.
We have time, which I sincerely hope we will, given the time we've been given today. I'll touch on it.
Yes, well, hopefully. Although I should warn you, Commissioner Morton has asked specifically if we can finish slightly before 1 p.m. As there is a matter on the council agenda that she wants to be at the council meeting for between 1 and 2. So, and I'm sure that we will be able to accommodate that.
I'm very much interested in being in the public forum during that meeting as well.
Quite, she is considering that as on the public excluded agenda. So.
Yeah.
Well, certainly will save you the walk.
Well, I'm interested in the public open agenda. Fascinating what happens in this district. And the second general comment I wanted to make is that it's interesting, you do all this work and lodge submissions and then come back and read them prior to hearing and think, oh, that's all a bit negative and critical. And I'd just like to emphasise the fact that the way these hearings go, we tend to focus on the things of concern. I note that we haven't commented on 95% of Chapter 21, 95% of Chapter 22, so they're quite important issues, but there's a lot of those chapters that haven't commented on, haven't critiqued. Now, I have some written. Taking a memorandum on board.
I think we might have to start doing this on resource consent here.
I know. So starting paragraph one, this presentation summary assumes that any other legal submissions that have been made have been read, and I highlight the current issues addressed in those legal submissions. The submissions and the related detailed legal submissions and the evidence to be presented focus on the extent to which the lot to be based on can accommodate additional rural living development by way of rezoning and or resource consent, and consequentially the extent to which chapters 21 and 22 should recognise and provide for existing and future rural living development of lots to be based on. That does not necessarily mean that the submission evidence may not have relevance in other parts of the basin, though the evidence is directed only to basin. I can elaborate slightly, Commissioners. I'm conscious that the panel is grappling with these issues on a wider range. I'm aware of the reports and questions yesterday that we obviously have a wider ambit. And I'm not going to take a legal point of view and say, well, my witnesses are only instructed to look at the basin and that's the limit of their brief. I haven't instructed them that. Accepting what their brief was about, if they can assist the panel in any way, response to any questions from the panel, they they should do their little best to do so. And I do ask you to take on board the fact that the focus of this case and that evidence and these submissions is the right to be placed.
I can be fair and say I think the focus of the entire hearing stream has been on the Waikato Basin, with the exception of the farmers and the Upcluther.
Right. And it is perhaps a pity in the sense that, you know, Wanaka has issues, flat land around Wanaka that's not O&L has issues, and hopefully somebody will address them. And the fact that we're proposing, and in fact, Mr. Brown, who's appearing tomorrow, specifically put to me, well, I've dealt with Waikato Basin, but what about Wanaka? And I had to say to him, well, I'm sorry, my clients aren't paying you to sort out Wanaka. But if you can assist the panel when we get questions, please do so. Paragraph 3, concerns we raised about our process. The primary issue here is the standard fairness. The submissions in stage 1, lodged by each submitted, will be dealt with in 3 or 4 separate hearing streams. The difficulty raised by separate constituted hearing panels arises from the fact that each submission involves what is effectively both a higher to lower and a lower to higher consideration process. The higher to lower aspect involves submissions of evidence which start with higher order chapters 3 and 6 objectives and policies, and then cascade down through middle order chapters 21 and 22 objectives, policies, rules, chapter 27 subdivision objectives, policies, rules, to the lower order individual rezoning requests. An example, particularly relevant to this group of submitters, is the planning evidence presented by Mrs. Farrell and Brown in relation to chapters 3 and 6 provisions relating to rural living, rural landscape classification in the basin. Consequential planning evidence being presented in this hearing stream relating to chapters 21 and 22. Future planning evidence being presented in relation to chapter 27. And future planning evidence to be presented in relation to individual rezoning requests. Evidence and related submissions presented during each hearing stream is relevant to all of the others and must be considered at the same time as evidence and submissions presented with each of the others. In the lower and higher aspect, in my submission relates to the necessary technical determinations. Not only has the Council not carried out the first principles landscape analysis in relation to the 96.7%, that's the correct figure, of those which is ONL-ONF, and has not carried out a first principles landscape analysis of the balance RLC parts of the rural zone or the RL or RR zones. In my calculation, somewhat less than 3.3% of the district once you take up the non-rural zones. And if I can just comment on that
briefly. It's smaller than that, Mr. Goldsmith, because it isn't 100 minus 96.7, 3.3. That must be significantly smaller.
Correct, that's what I'm saying.
But I would have thought you'd put significant rather than somewhat.
I wasn't sure, but I overstayed my case. And if I can comment on that, because I think it's relevant to the issues that the panel is facing. This is a district where landscape is prevalent, which everybody agrees. 17 years ago, when the first district plan was considered by the Environment Court, this district got caned by the Environment Court for not starting with the landscape analysis and not giving the Environment Court the factual data for the Environment Court to make its determinations. 17 years later, we are repeating the same process. We are having to address issues without the benefit of a first principles landscape analysis. That might be considered surprising, considering the importance of that issue to this district. And I found it interesting that on the 4th of April there was an article in the paper advising that the council intends to double its budget for district plan review from 3.3 million to 6.3 million. And it seems a pity that possibly the very first task that was instructed was to go out there and analyse the landscape. And I say on my next point that point creates a difficulty for the panel in my submission, because detailed evidence as to the absorption capacity of different parts of the areas we're dealing with may not or will not be presented until the rezoning hearings next year. Now that evidence in my submission will have a lower to higher effect, because it will be relevant to the middle order objectives, policies and rules, and the higher order objectives and policies. And this difficulty I'm referring to, again, I think the panel has a difficulty, the submitters have a difficulty, because we're coming along and submitting in the absence of that base data, and it's not for submitters to incur the cost of sorting out the Waikato Basin or the Wanaka in the Upper Basin. It's the council's job, which is now delegated to you. But it creates difficulties for all of us, and we end up in the Environment Court. Maybe we'll create difficulties for the council's legal advisors, because I was there last time and the council's legal advisors were chastised robustly by the Environment Court due to the fact that there was no landscape analysis to start. So I think we're all in a difficult position in trying to figure out the very fundamental point about the absorption capacity of the Waikato Basin and to what extent can it take more of it. And we have to, we're here, we are where we are, can't go away and start again, but we all have to deal with it. So the point I'm emphasising here in paragraph 8 is that evidence and submissions presented to all these hearing streams is relevant to each hearing stream. The different components of each case must be considered together and be the subject of a combined and consistent recommendations. And the concern being expressed is how that will be achieved under the current process. At that point, Mr. Chairman, can I repeat what I said earlier? I've been briefed by my partner, Ms. Galloway. You don't need to repeat the discussion we had yesterday. I think what I proposed in my detailed legal submissions as being the only way forward is effectively what's going to happen with the South Coast. We're going to have to rely on the panels to be there. Can I also pass on that our firm is not the only one concerned about this issue? And my suggestion that the panel may wish to issue a minute, just clarifying what was discussed yesterday to everybody, may assist other people to understand, because I've had other councils talk to me about this issue, because as we've grappled with it, as we've got into it, we've kind of realised to a greater extent how significant this issue is. So I can advise everybody that may help. Moving on, paragraph 9. The detailed legal submissions relating to the existing environment and the future environment should not raise any issue that is not well understood. The building and building platform maps are directly relevant to this issue as it affects the Waikato Basin. I emphasise the guidance of Justice Fogarty, quoted in the legal submissions, where he said where some of that land is already the subject of resource consents like implemented, and the plan has not yet been made for that locality, it is natural enough that the territorial authority has to write a plan which accommodates the existing activity. So, my underlining. Now, given the emphasis on landscape considerations in this district, the landscape starting point is really important. And by starting point, I'm talking about the Waikato Basin and what is there now. On that issue, I emphasise the very significant acknowledgement by Dr. Reed that she agrees with the concluding paragraph of Mr. Baxter's hearing stream No. 1 evidence, which reads, "The rural living character I have described above varies throughout the Waikato Basin in terms of location, density, and the extent to which it has affected local landscape character. As a consequence, there are some areas of the basin which should be rezoned as rural residential, rural lifestyle. Some areas where I believe rural living development should be avoided, and other areas which can accommodate limits to a greater or lesser extent, potentially including urban development. I have not been briefed to address this in detail, and I understand that will be dealt with during my appearance. My submission, Commissioner, is there has been no expert landscape evidence presented which challenges that conclusion agreed between Dr. Reed and Mr. Baxter, not the record file. When addressing this issue, the detailed legal submission is omitted to refer to the evidence of Yvonne Fuda. Part 4 of that evidence, under the heading Review of Landscape Character of Waikato Basin, addressed that issue, specifically referred to the evidence of Mr. Baxter's evidence, and arrived at a conclusion almost identical to the conclusion agreed between Dr. Reed and Mr. Baxter. I again elaborate slightly, Commissioners, and interestingly, this is one very good example of the split hearing issue, because that acknowledgement by Dr. Reed was an exchange with the Commissioners. The reason I outlined this in detail in my written legal submissions and repeated it here is I wanted to be sure that Commissioner Coombs and Commissioner Lawton unaware of it, because it is, you know, it is fundamentally important to the case being presented. The expert evidence, all the expert evidence on landscape, is there isn't even a debate that there is capacity in the Rocky Basin for more development on landscape grounds. No one's challenging it. No expert's challenging it. Which I think I quoted in my legal submissions, as Robinson said at the time, that makes sense. But it is a, you know, it is a particularly important point, and it has been established in evidence.
Mr. Goldsmith, just while we're on that, a question. You suggested us several times that we should probably look at C-180-99, which I did, and I'm now a bit sad that I can just rattle that off my tongue, not even thinking about it. And you talked about that particular case, and it's that we should read it, and I've understood some way that we should rely on it, or is that fair?
There were important issues in that case and others that I submitted to the government, such as the discussion about openness and O&L, so
yes.
Aspects of that case, which, I mean, the case is almost 20 years ago.
Yes.
Some aspects would have been overtaken by time, but on a legal point of view, there are some aspects which I submitted to remain relevant.
Yeah. Well, just what you said about the, where the expert evidence is agreed on, that there is ability to absorb. Then how do we take into account, and I'm referring to page 81, 136, where it says we find there has been an inappropriate urban sprawl in the basin, in particular areas, and they go on to say that we consider the cumulative effects have already gone further than is desirable.
So
how do we balance that up with the evidence that you've just told us about, and how much attention should we pay to that? I'm happy to, if you want to look at the full thing here, although you possibly know it.
My recollection, correct me if I'm wrong, I look at this, my recollection was that the environment was referring to specific areas. I think they examined.
So Centennial Road,
Good Avenue, Junior.
Mulligan Road, McDonald Road.
Sorry.
I'm not sure what you said. Sorry.
In paragraph 136, the Wakami Basin needs to be treated as a special case as a coherent whole. We provide there has been inappropriate evidence for the basin, in particular on Centennial Road, the Slim Arrow Junction, and here along parts of Mulligan Road on its south side.
And
it was talking about urban sprawl. So I think that is relevant. I think that is relevant to the issue we're talking about, and that different parts of the basin are different. In that particular case, the court identified one area where it thought that things had gone too far and there were cumulative effects that were inappropriate. So if you drive along that little area, you'd probably see that. But I would not read that statement as saying that the entire basin is, should we say, for.
Over the page where it says we consider the cumulative effects have already gone further than desirable.
Again, I would submit that that is related to a specific area. Bearing in mind that there have been a number of cases since then, such as Hawthorne, where the Environment Court made a final investigation and approved the whole order.
So in the evidence that's going to be presented by your people, are they going to identify for us areas where that, where the ability to absorb may be appropriate?
When we come to rezoning, that's the issue I'm making. At this point we're saying the landscape experts are in agreement that there is scope. They all say in some areas of one number of years. We have no broad council landscape assessment except for Dr. Reed's June 2014 report,
yes,
which I previously said was a good starting point.
Mm.
And then in your rezoning requests, you're going to get a whole bunch of people turning up saying, well, this bit can take some, and this bit can take some, and that bit can take some, and that bit can take some. And you're going to have to
your witnesses, in terms of pre-reading, have all suggested that for the entire rural lifestyle, that it should all be one hectare average density with no minimum. How does that apply if we're only looking at that might be appropriate in some areas but not others?
Well, first of all, that evidence applies, but then that evidence is focused on the area zone rural lifestyle, not the waste. I mean, the dark green on that, the existing and the proposed. So the evidence about rural lifestyle is focused on that. And then secondly, when we come to the zoning requests, there will be, and I'm not sure whether one of the issues I suspect you're going to be faced with is there a solution, is one solution for everything? Or are there specific solutions for specific areas? And you're going to be faced with a number of very detailed cases with planning and landscape on this property, and this bit, and that bit, and that bit. And one of the challenges that you're going to be facing, I mean, at the end of it, one of the advantages you're going to have is you're going to have detailed evidence on probably most of the areas in the basin that anybody thinks for the development can be absorbed. And I keep referring to the northern side of Melbourne Drake because no one's submitted me. And it seems to be a fairly wide agreement that it's a pretty important area. And no one's asking about them. There are other submissions being lodged for specific areas. And given the number of submissions, I suspect you may well have a submission on virtually any area which possibly can absorb some. I don't know whether it goes that far, because there will always be in the rural zone pocket here or a little place here where you wouldn't zone it rural lifestyle, but it might accommodate a house. And of course, that's where we get to the rural asset preservation assessment house. Always back to my admin submission, but I think this is the most difficult task facing this panel. Paragraph 4. There's no expedientary dispute about the proposition that the basin can absorb additional rural development. The only questions which remain are related, related questions of how that should be recognised in the Woven Forward District Plan, which is an objective policy issue, and where it should be located, which is probably a rezoning issue, in part. Now, the Council's case for hearing Stream 02 hardly mentions rural living in the Wellington Basin. Set that out and made detailed submissions. This appears to be because of a fundamental assumption that the only relevant considerations are landscape considerations, and therefore that the only relevant objectives and policies are in Chapter 6. I submit that any such assumption is fundamentally incorrect and leads to a significant flaw in Chapter 21, which that it does not address rural living in the Wellington Basin. I'm thinking further about that submission point. It appeared to me to go back and look at the operative plan, and it appears to me that I wasn't going to say the same error has been made, I'm going to rephrase that as the same approach has been adopted. The operative district plan, the rural zone, is quite enabling. It refers to rural living in some places, but it's generic, and the constraints that they were are in Chapter 4, the landscape chapter. In part, the operative plan ended up that way because of the environment. I mean, the plan that went to the environment court, which I'll try now completely just about, on these issues, and we ended up with a complete rewrite of issues relating to this development of the rural zone. And therefore, it was almost being done for the first time at the environment court. And we ended up with a process without letting up that evidence, we ended up with a plan which, and I'm talking about outside the OBLs, has generic policies and objectives and assessment matters and relies on the case by case approach. So, anywhere in the rural zone, if you apply for a house, you have the same set of objectives and policies with no specific guidance. And you had to work your way through a whole bunch of detailed assessment matters. And what we've got in this plan is the same approach at the moment. We have landscape objectives and policies, some generic rural zone policies which don't provide any guidance in terms of where development, this kind of development might go. And then we have assessment plans. So we're kind of doing the same thing again. And what I'm suggesting is that...
Well, can I remind you, Mr. Goldsmith, that when I questioned him, Mr. Baxter said that the Opera plan is working well in the Waikato Basin. So if the same regime is put in place, then that must be appropriate in terms of Mr. Baxter's evidence.
For the Waikato Basin, yes.
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 I think your submissions and your evidence are focused on the Waikato Basin, and I have to say the Waikato Basin is a different case
yes.
from other parts of the district.
That's precisely the point I'm trying to make.
And we understand that.
Yes,
but the difficulty I have with your submission that Chapter 21 should provide for rural living in the Waikato Basin in its bold statement is that that says that Chapter 22 is irrelevant because Chapter 22 is about rural living. Now, what's the point of having both chapters focused on rural living in the Waikato Basin?
The rural living zone, and it may well be as a result of rezoning hearings, a lot more of the basin ends up in rural living with different, possibly different controls, and that's a possibility down the track.
I'd hate to think that we ended up with a whole series of spot zones like Hong Kong.
Well,
I've just been dealing with that problem.
Well,
and I have to say, one of the problems with the Opera plan is that every individual landowner got their own solution, and that's not necessarily planning or resource management. That's similar to ad hoc, the ad hocery that is not planning. So I'd like to think that we could come with a sensible solution that could deal with the issues, but with a rational approach that provided for the differentiation between the areas which are obviously available for rural living, and that may require some, that will require some hearings and mapping, but some areas have already been identified. And the other areas, Ms. Flevers yesterday said in her evidence, well, the questioning actually, that there is the potential to put some development in particular locations within the rolling landscape, but not in a, if you like, 1 to a hectare approach, or 1 to 2 hectares, or 1 to 4,000 square metres. So that suggests to me that what we're looking at, what she is suggesting in the rural zone, is some form of continuation of a case-by-case basis. Wouldn't that be the approach that she is suggesting indicate?
Two or three different questions on what you said, sir.
Well, I'd like to make that difficult for you.
I was agreeing in principle that, well, obviously we agree that Waikato Basin is different, as a special case, that there should be a coherent approach to it. To a degree, our presentation is constrained by the way the plan is structured and by the fact that each of our clients has specific pieces of land. So, as I said before, it doesn't need to do the whole thing. And I would certainly have no difficulty with the concept that out of all of this comes a different approach.
We've just taken the submissions that Ms. Baker Galloway made yesterday and that you have also made, I've not gone into detail on scope. That opportunity is there, is it not, to present a wider, within the bounds, approach, albeit that your delivery clients may have just a narrow focus within that 5,000?
Yes, yes. That's a fair comment. And I don't want what I said earlier to be taken away from the appropriateness of case by case, because landscape generally in the space, and I would argue that the discretionary case by case regime in the last 17 years has worked generally well. And all the studies suggest that. I think you can go right back to the council's monitoring report on the rules studies. The only real concern raised was the human effects issue. Was, you know, where does it stop? So case by case, for areas that aren't zoned rural, I mean, you know, if you have, there are some areas where you might say, well, a certain level of development, take the triangle, and the kind of over-domestication issue, if the intent is to keep it kind of rural and not urban, then you need to have a minimum lot size to stop the do-do-do-do-do-do-do, and just gradually over time changing from rural to urban. There has to be a base. But there will be other areas where you would probably need, you couldn't zone, sorry, phrase that. You either leave it case to case, or you have a whole bunch of different specific zones seeking to get different outcomes. And trying to think of an example, well, foreshadowing an example, that we will be presenting later, which may change as well in council's meeting today. There are a number of submitters who have submitted on land beside the lady's mine. And we've always anticipated that no one's going to come along and say, carve it up into 2 hectares or 1 hectare. The lady's mine is special, and there needs to be a site-specific location. If there is going to be development allowed, there should be certain parameters for the setbacks and location. And if you were going to rezone parts of Ladies Mile for additional rural living development, we wouldn't be arguing the standard 1 hectare or standard 2 hectare. We'd be saying this is a special case. It needs special rules. Now, whether that's on a case-by-case basis or a special zone, I'm not sure you get away from the fact that it's very hard to get a one-size-fits-all solution, I think so.
Isn't that what resource consents are for? Mm.
Yes, yes.
I understand the value of zone provisions, especially on large lots, you know, towards hectares, because one can't develop them overnight. But I don't think we're talking about any instances of sites of that magnitude in the basin.
No, but I would argue that one of the, if there's one disadvantage of the case-by-case approach, is the uncertainty of the cost. And
we've had that
for 17 years, and it's, you know, given its uncertainties and its cost quite a bit of money, it's ended up in an outcome. If you can devise a plan which actually provides more guidance, I'll stick with Ladies Mile example. If you can see a solution, say, okay, if you did that, that would be okay, you preserve that, and you can see that solution, then if you put that solution into the plan, then the consent applications that follow are straightforward and easy, and you know what the outcome is. If you leave it case by case, then you end up with where we've been for 17 years, which is every single one is an apple for a debate. And surely out of this hearing, there must be some opportunity, I would have thought, in the basin to end up with greater specificity.
Is it that, in fact, from what you're saying, and certainly some of the evidence we've heard so far, what may be required on the basis of some sort of master planning to
stolen my question.
I like doing that. Some sort of master planning approach for the entire basin, rather than and that may be something that we should talk to the council about. In parallel with these hearings, rather than us having to effectively do the master planning as a result of submissions, which may not actually incorporate all the people, all the lots that are involved. Is that...
It's effectively precisely what happened in submission. I said it's a pity there hasn't been a landscape analysis of the basin. Because if we'd started with that landscape analysis, and if Dr. Lee's June...
Well, it's not just a landscape analysis, it's actually rather more than that. Well, it's a planning analysis.
It's a planning, yes. But if we had that starting point, then you might end up with the basin with a lot more specificity in it. And we're kind of coming to it backwards.
Do you know, Mr. Goldsmith, why things like master planning or structure plans haven't heard anyone tell me, or I haven't seen whether it's one of those that's applied within the district? You've been operating here for a while.
Friends and Banks has got a problem. Unfortunately, it happens in separate zones. Chesapeake's got a master plan, the country's got a master plan. Franklin Flats, parts of the Franklin Flats have a master plan. It's been done because we're up to plan change 51 since that's the council plan change. No, yeah, we're up to plan change 51 in 17 years. People keep coming on the master plan, and that's the reality. And I would have to agree in principle. A master plan walked in the basin, given that you have one big debate. Because everybody could argue that. But at least you'd be doing it on the basis of a coherent whole.
I don't want to stop the proceedings at the moment, and I'd like to hear the rest of your submissions and your evidence, and the evidence we're hearing tomorrow from Mr. Brown. But it's occurring to me that it might be that we initiate some discussions with the council about whether that be looked at to deal with this specific area. And I don't know, well, I know they don't have much in the way of resources, but I don't know.
They just doubled the budget.
You know, that hasn't doubled the number of people on the ground. And but I'll certainly have a talk to Mr. Avery about whether that might be possible as a way of dealing with that, and we could put off hearing the rezoning matters until there was some resolution. If that was to occur, that would all become one part of the process. It just strikes me as that we're all, I think all of us want to solve the problem.
Yes.
And I'm not sure that a hearing process is necessarily the best way to do it.
I would agree with that completely. I mean, and in a funny way, you say, do they have the resources? But you're going to get 10 separate reports.
Mm.
10 but separate 42A reports on 10 or 15 separate areas.
Yes.
All of which is going to go into a lot of detail. Everyone of those is going to have a landscape report.
That has occurred to me.
Planning report. Mm. And you actually said to them, now go away and give us a global section 42A report that addresses all of these individual submissions in a framework
and
fills in the bits in between, then you get one report rather than 10 reports.
Well, I'd like to see that it would be done properly and with adequate consultation. That may actually defuse to a large extent the issues in the basin. That would be my hope.
It would certainly give all of the submitters a document to react to. I mean, we probably shouldn't have hearings because I'm sure everyone wasn't going to agree, but it could be in my submission, a more sensible and probably more cost effective way to proceed for everybody, all the submitters and the council. And if we're not doing it for next year anyway, which I don't think we are.
Well, and it might obviate years of litigation in the environment court as well, which is even more expensive for the council.
I had no doubt the environment court would appreciate dealing with a coordinated approach rather than what we're in the middle of now.
I'll make a note of that before we proceed.
And finish up by paragraph 13, I may just put the thought. I know our submission that there should be specific and future policy guidance for voluntary basins necessarily mean there shouldn't also be Veronica or other areas, but that's not what we're dealing with today. 14, I said that the council's case is flawed, and I summarised what's in my legal submissions. The apparent assumption of the overall considerations of landscape, failure to present economic evidence in hearing stream 01. Now that economic evidence has been prepared for both 01 and 02, it's generic. It specifically states it's not a full quantitative or qualitative cost benefit analysis, and it doesn't refer to rural living at all. And obviously, we'll take from our legal submissions, commissioners, that we're placing some weight on the fact that there are economic and social benefits arising from rural living. And 15, I said, looking at the council's evidence, is undermined by those failures and the failure to carry out a 32.2 assessment in particular. Prior to those submissions, in the case we presented, that Chapter 21 should address existing and future rural living development in the Waterloo Basin. The evidence we presented informs the required Section 32 assessment. I'm talking about the valuers' evidence and the planning evidence as well as the landscape as well as the planning. And supports the amendments proposed by Mr. Farrell and Mr. Brown. The extent of those amendments is considered. Talking about this lack of landscape analysis, and by the fact that you won't get detailed evidence relating to specific areas until the rezoning hearings. Those hearings, something to what we've been talking about, could well lead to further refinement of Chapter 21. This is the lowest one. I wanted to touch on two minor legal issues which I didn't address in the legal submissions. First is Rule 21.721, which is an introduction to the RL, Rural Landscape Assessment Matters. I just ask you to look at the wording of that compared to the wording of the assessment matters. I mean, the underline on balance. I read this and I just have great difficulty seeing how it was intended to be applied and how someone would explain it in the environment which I'm sure it's intended to be applied. I mean, does on balance mean if you comply with 7 out of 12 and not 5 out of 12, you get a tick? The phrase consistent with the criteria, if you read the assessment matters, they're not criteria. They're whether and the extent to which roading follows the natural form of the landscape. Whether and the extent to which. So you answer the assessment matter by saying, well, yes, it does partially, it does, doesn't a little bit. How do you then judge whether that assessment matter has been met or not? But each assessment matter is a continuum. I just cannot see as a lawyer how you apply that introductory, what is meant to be introductory guidance, because the assessment matters aren't criteria in my submission. And the second point, which relates to all the rules, in the case of a proposed residential activity or specific development, whether a specific building design helps demonstrate. Two points. I'm not quite sure what specific building design means. Does it mean house plans? Or if you turn up with, as we often turn up with, maximum height, 4 metres, flat roof, brown or grey exterior, this kind of landscaping, is that a building design or are those building controls? So just there's a bit of uncertainty around that phrase. And my second point, and my primary concern, is that is the word helps. Because in any case, a specific house design is easier to assess than design controls. It's plainly obvious. If you get a specific house design to assess, that is easier than somebody coming along and saying, we want to put a house in this building platform and it's going to be so high and a pitched roof and these are the materials. Because there's a whole bunch of outcomes of that. My concern, knowing how councils start, is that that wording will result in every case having to provide a specific design. Because it always happens.
I have to say, Mr. Goldsmith, as a hearing commissioner, I've turned down one application in this district for the specific reason that the information provided was inadequate to enable an assessment to be made. And that is an instance where a specific housing design may have actually enabled me to grant consent. So there is, I understand your point about it being easier, but it's also that there are many cases, probably, where a specific design would advance the applicant's case significantly. And while the wording may not be appropriate to emphasise that, there's probably going to be a mentioning that in the plans, isn't there?
Oh, I don't agree with any of that. And the evidence that you're going to give by Mr. Farrell or Mr. Brown, right, changes helps to is necessary. It's necessary to demonstrate. Because I have no difficulty with the fact that in the O&L in particular, where it's normally more sensitive, you frequently have to go to the extent of the very specific controls or a house design.
But to be fair, in other parts of the country, people go to photo montages.
My point here, and it is supported by Dr. Reed in paragraph 6.35 of her evidence, where she says frequently in the ONL specific house designs are presented. I agree that frequently in the ONL it happens. My concern is this rule applies to everything, and especially the rural landscape, but 90% probably of applications are not by the person who's going to build the house. They're subdividers creating a building platform to sell, and they're not going to build the house. So if you have to do a specific house design to get consent, there's quite a cost involved, and the buyer may not want that anyway. So it is appropriate in sensitive areas, but not generic. Now, paragraph 18, economic landscape containing evidence of presented with system panel consideration of rural lifestyle zone rules, which are challenged, particularly the 2 hectare density requirement. And we just got a final elaboration, and putting aside the discussion we just had, can I suggest this isn't as complicated an issue as it may seem? The simple fact is the 2 hectare, the reason which has been explained, doesn't have a particular planning background. A number of students across the board have requested my EP, and it wasn't like it was all coordinated. I mean, I was interested. We lodged submissions requesting it, and I was interested to see how many other submissions were lodged requesting. I think I saw one asking for 1.5, but everybody's 2 hectare or one. The benefits are obvious, economic, social, they've all been laid out. It's 2 versus 1. The simple question of my submission is, considering the evidence, do the disbenefits outweigh the benefits? And there may be a supplementary issue as to, is it appropriate everywhere or only somewhere? But just the 1 versus 2, I suggest, is quite simple. There's a lot of people asking for it. There's a strong case for it. The only real question is, are there disbenefits which outweigh that case? I don't think you have to get into it. Should it be 1.3 or 1.5 or 1.7? It's a couple of black and white. And my submission. Those are my submissions. Do you have any other questions? I'll be able to answer them.
Okay. Do you have any other questions?
I have written some down. I'll just work out whether they're around. In paragraph 9.9, from the top of page 40. It's a quote from Dr. Reed. Evidence or a report. It says the rural landscape zone. That's the zone in the Oxford plan rather than a zone that's proposed.
I understood that statement to Dr. Reed saying I have to move from the rural lifestyle zone to the rural landscape classification area. That's what I meant. And she's talking about the RLC.
Which is the one in the op?
No, it's proposed. Oh, yeah, it's the rural landscape, it's the non-ONL, or non-ONL rural, which is called rural landscape classification. I think we've dropped that classification, so we have rural landscape. So you're right, my paragraph 9.10 little A is not quite, and B is not quite correctly worded. I shouldn't have said the rural landscape zone, I should have said the rural landscape classification area of the rural landscape.
Paragraph 9.18. I was trying to understand at the top of page 42 there, the problem with the statement is that non-compliance with minimum residential density rules triggers non-complying activity status, which does not invite or anticipate consideration on a case-by-case basis. Doesn't it do that? You can, in sunny prohibited activities that you can't apply for?
Technically, yes, but substantively, I'm not sure whether Mr. Winchester will agree, because when we talk about case by case, the general thing around here is if you're discretionary, and it's case by case, you might get there or you might not, depending on the circumstances. As soon as you get to non-complying, you're talking about precedent and the integrity of the plan. And I would argue that the statement to Mr. Winchester's statement that it's appropriate that the capacity of land will come at a high density as assessed on a case by case basis is not correct for a non compliant activity, because fundamentally a plan does not anticipate non compliant activities. It anticipates they won't, as well as if it's discretionary, it anticipates they might or might not. And I'm just not sure whether Mr. Winchester appreciated when he made that statement that, in fact, the density trigger is non-compliant, not discretionary.
So there would have been, so at the moment there's no density trigger within the ODP that someone would have.
It's exactly the same regime at the moment. Because always subdivide first.
But if people are applying for these, how many have been granted and how many haven't as non-complying activities? Is there any information around that?
I imagine the council could provide that. I'm not aware off the top of my head of any successful applications who subdivide in the rural lifestyle zone below the minimum density. But it doesn't seem they're not there. But if they're there, I would be very surprised if they're not there. Those non-complying triggers are pretty strongly applied.
In terms of 10.1, this is around the 500 metre house size limitation. Have you had a chance to look at the information the council provided on how many consents and what the size of the buildings are?
I'm aware of that one.
I think, to be fair, on that one, we've received a table from Mr. Barr, but we haven't received an email from Mr. Barr. Is that?
It has been filed.
Right.
Sure.
So So, yes, you don't know the answer.
You don't know the answer. I'd
be surprised if there were many out there better than 500. I'm sure there's some, but 500 is quite good. It is quite large.
I think that was as clear as ever yesterday. I think she used rather more than quite large.
That's right.
I think she used more than quite large. She might have done a lot more than that. She said very large.
Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. This notion, this idea that council hasn't undertaken a first principles landscape assessment. Of course, we're in the unique situation in this district where we've got a history of 17 years of case law, starting from the C180/99, which sets up the factors that are generally applied throughout the country. I wonder if with the benefit of that case law, we've got a situation here where would you consider that a first principles landscape assessment that wasn't entirely consistent with the guidance that we've had from the court over a long period of time could provide other issues for the council?
Could provide
other issues for the council?
Other commissioners will forgive me for that. I address this issue in detail here in 301, which is part of my concern about this issue. The thing about not having had a first principles analysis was just taken from the evidence that was given in the reports that were presented. And the concerns that were raised here in 301 was that we were just rolling over an existing situation without actually going back and examining it. And the ORL, and I'm not, I dealt with the ORL area at some length in here in 301. I was really trying to make the point here that for the 3.3% we haven't got. And there is actually quite a lot of information there for ORLs, although we still have the somewhat strange situation where 96.7% of the district is ORL, which is interesting given a lot of the court guidance about outstanding and preliminary. Whether it creates issues on it or not, it might just, I don't know. If you can carry it out, I don't know what the outcome would be. The point really was that the funding industry might run into concerns we expressed were that we were simply rolling over kind of an existing something without actually going back and examining whether it was appropriate.
Yeah, well, I should say I've given advice to many clients that the best place to start is, of course, the first principles district-wide landscape assessment. That is, it's where everybody should start. I'm wondering if that first principles landscape assessment has been carried out by the court over the last 17 years with input from many, many practitioners and looking at the different corners of the district. I'm wondering if it's been done in a different way, and perhaps what Ms. Reid, Dr. Reid, has attempted to do is to try and pull it together.
I acknowledge that's what she's attempted to do. I guess one of the issues that arises on district plan review is inevitably all those environment court cases they go around and a piece here and a piece here and a piece here, and you have all sorts of evidence about whether this piece is ORL or not, and therefore your measure of comparison tends to be on the evidence you're given, which is about that piece. I think the point was about the industry about one world. It's just interesting that, and depending on how much that's been examined by the environment court, I'll make sure we're going to read that report in detail, how much of the 96.7% has been examined by the environment court specifically. It just hasn't, no one's kind of stepped back, which you kind of think you might do in a review stage and say, well, given that piecemeal sporadic approach right through, have we ended up at what is the right solution? Coming back to it, but there's quite a bit of case law on preeminent and outstanding. And one of the issues of this district, of course, is that the landscapes are so spectacular on a countrywide basis that everybody considers outstanding.
Yes.
Is that right for a district, given the case law? You know, would we end up 96.7%, or would the bar end up being higher because we are the Queensland Arts District? And related to that is, of course, inside the 96.7%, the rules are pretty stringent. It's a pretty stringent regime. In the operative plan, there is a very stringent regime for the ONLWA, the ONL Red Lottery Basin. There's a slightly less stringent regime for everywhere else. The proposed plan proposes lifting the slightly less stringent, but to the very stringent. Which is, has potential implications for a bunch of landowners. I don't think this is really wrong, it's just sometimes you think in the review you might just take that step back and say, well, is this quite right? And without the first principles analysis, I'm not sure there's any other way to do it. I mean, I don't really see this criticising Dr. Reid in her approach, because I suspect she can agree for the budget.
As all district plan reviews do.
As all district plan reviews do, but this is the Queensland Ace District on this landscape. This is our bread, butter, future, livelihood. Yeah.
So maybe another way of approaching it or thinking about it is that maybe the approach that council's taken actually pays more respect to 17 years of case law than starting again.
That's a big one. Although related to that, there was a bit of a philosophical debate, probably aware of, when this process started. And the council started discussions about the district plan review, and the planning fraternity in its entirety, the private planning fraternity in its entirety, said, don't check out what you've got. It's working pretty well. Take it. Tweak the bits that aren't working. Reformat it if you want to. But let's not start again. And the council threw it out and started again.
The reason for me making that comment is probably in light of your suggestion that last time around the council got caned for not doing the job properly in the first place. But this time around, maybe they've been listening to the court for 17 years and have learned from that.
And the court may well say that, yeah. My focus for today is on the 3.3%,
yes,
which is where the development pressure is.
Yes.
I mean, the O&L is pretty tough out there.
Yeah.
It's very hard to get something. So all the development pressures in the 3.3%, and should we have done perhaps at least said, okay, leave the 96.7% because it's okay, but should we have done the 3.3% better? This goes back to the discussion that I've asked about in the place. Continue to say someone shouldn't forget Wanaka, because Wanaka has different issues in the Wanaka place, and it's got pressures too. And is there any guidance in what we have for the Wanaka make for in our food place? Which I hope is no less important than the Waxhippie Basin. It just isn't under the same, it's much larger and there are less people, so there's less pressure to have at the moment.
Thank you.
Commissioner Hawthorne, do you have any?
Yes, but it's a bit more to apologise. I'm just trying to think through. And this idea of master planning. I guess you made a comment in your opening statement around that there's been plenty of evidence around the environmental, economic, social impacts and I guess considerations across the, particularly the Waxhippie. And I've actually been on a bit of a hobby horse to ask about the social values of what we consider might be supported through the living, through the lifestyle zone, rural lifestyle zone. Because there hasn't been a lot of discussion about them. If we were to be master planning, would you consider that maybe the social impacts across the region in terms of land use could be, I guess, assessed against social value or the social context?
Well, given the definition of the environment and the beginning parts of the RMA, any impact or effect is worthy of assessment. The evidence you've been given is limited, I acknowledge it's limited to a degree, has been limited to Mr. Saul's evidence and Mr. Lee's evidence, and I can change hats as late as last week, is that people benefit from it. People who buy them, people who live in them, and their visitors all get social benefits from it. Having acknowledged the place of benefits accruing to the purchases that people have given there. As I do, I live in the country. I enjoy it. So it's a benefit. Are there wider social benefits? It's an interesting question.
I'm trying to
give you a good answer. Well, there are some wider social benefits in terms of the fact that someone's going to build all the houses and look after all the houses, so there's employment, which creates jobs for people who may not be living there. Are there more, I'm not sure, abstruse or intangible social benefits or disbenefits? Would be a question you probably should put to somebody who's the expert of assessing intangible social benefits and disbenefits.
I asked the economist yesterday, and he said there's absolutely no way that you should go anywhere that's going to be soon. You should have noticed we should have done that. But,
it's a question of identifying what the potential intangible social benefits or disbenefits are and saying, do they exist? We're kind of talking in a vacuum here. What are we talking about? You can go, you know, social benefits or disbenefits in a wider sense, like people who drive through the basement, they're good. Now then you have an issue, of course. Some people will say, well, the basement in Horton is a blaze of wood because it's developed. Other people take a different view on the development in the basement. So it gets very subjective.
It does, and this Oxford's report does touch on it, and to sum that up.
He talks about the economic benefits of the landscape generally, and if you read his report, it's almost in this conclusion, it's entirely very clearly going on.
How it relates to
tourism. Hmm? And tourism, yeah. And how the ONL supports the tourism and vice versa. I found very little in his economic evidence which assisted with the issue of rural and what's the best. Obviously, you never decide that, but his attention wasn't directed there. There was no specific evidence in relation to it, no benefits identified.
I have no clue. I'm just wondering, Mr. Goldsmith, could you cast 11 rather than starting a witness and then breaking the question? Maybe we'll take the morning agenda now.
Please,
sir.
Please,
sir. We'll adjourn until 11:30.